I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that, like Fox Mulder, wants to believe. We're back to look at those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm David Steele, filling in again for the irreplaceable Rebecca Chatwin. And you join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, magazines, and more.
Oh, well done, Dave. Very well done. Do you know what? It's got to the point, I can say that without having to look at a list, but it trips off the tongue when you've done it a few times.
It really does. I did have a little practice of it earlier on. Obviously, I've heard Rebecca say it so many times, you almost pick it up by osmosis.
Yeah, that's true. And well, this week, we are going to be featuring The Dolby Spook by Lauren Mooney and Stuart Pringle, which was one of the stories included in an Eighth Doctor box set, which was released at the end of last year, What Lies Inside? We've already featured another story that was released in the box set after this, Albie's Angels. So we're sticking around in recent Eighth Doctor territory for this episode. So Dave, what does the Big Finish website have to tell us about this story, The Dolby Spook?
Right. Clear throat, Doc's best reading voice. After encountering Harry Price, the Doctor decides to solve an infamous case before the paranormal debunker can. But Liv and Helen are more concerned for the girl at the centre of events. What is really going on at the remote Isle of Man farmhouse? And who is Jeff, the talking mongoose? And we're now going to hear an excerpt.
Come out, wherever you are. What did you say?
Turn that off and go to the devil.
Bothering you, is it?
You're ringing in my ears like a damn gramophone.
I'll switch it off if you answer me a few questions. What are you doing here?
I follow Vori.
All right, why?
She gives me food. Not so loud, it's fine.
You're feeding off her, is that it?
What a rotter. She feeds me.
Feeds you what?
Nuts.
I have to say, Dave, that before this, I'd never heard of Jeff. But since listening to this one, I've actually put on quite a few podcasts about him, especially the Folklore podcast, which is very good, and read up about him online a bit too. And there's about 40 different podcasts which feature him. Did you know much about him?
I'd never heard of it. The extent of my Isle of Man knowledge was probably the sketches from the Fast Show, to be honest. And, of course, our pal Mark Owen. Not that Mark Owen. But no, I was completely unaware of it. It was a very interesting story. I mean, those two McGann box sets last year were absolutely excellent. I listened to them both whilst painting the spare room at my sister's new flat. So that's the flashbacks that I'll be having the next time I'm painting. But as far as Jeff goes, according to Wikipedia, Jeff, also referred to as the Talking Mongoose or the Dolby Spook, was an allegedly talking mongoose which was claimed to inhabit a farmhouse owned by the Irving family. The Irving's farm was located at Cashin's Gap, that sounds a bit rude, near the hamlet of Dolby on the Isle of Man. The story was given extensive coverage by the tabloid press in Britain in the early 1930s. The Irving's claims gained the attention of parapsychologists and ghost hunters such as Harry Price, Hereward Carrington and Nandor Fodor. Blake seven names there. Some investigators of this era, as well as contemporary critics, have concluded that the phenomenon was a hoax that the Irving family perpetuated by using ventriloquism.
Interesting. I have to say, I having listened to it, I think there's something very bizarre about it all. I mean, I cannot believe that you'd get a talking mongoose, and I mean, apparently he could disappear by just going vanish, clapping his hands, and he'd disappear. But it's a fantastic story. It's something you couldn't make up.
But yes, it's got a touch of the Loch Ness monsters in a way to it, isn't it? You know, a sort of regional bit of mythology that certain people are very interested in working out if it's true or not. I was certainly charmed by the Big Finish story. Whether or not I believe it to be true or not, I don't know. I would have to do some more digging myself. Maybe I'll have to listen to some of those podcasts that you were talking about yourself.
yeah, I mean, the podcast, definitely worth a wee look around and see what you can find, because there's some really interesting comment and sort of comparison with like similar hauntings and poltergeists and possessions that took place around the same time. So, yeah, definitely a good listen.
Interesting. So, listeners, we're going to kick off our interviews for this episode with one of the co-authors of the story, and they'll explain where the other writer is for themselves.
Yeah, hi, I'm Stuart Pringle, and I'm the co-writer of Eighth Doctor Adventures, The Dalby Spook, among other Big Finish dramas.
I suppose you'd mention where your co-writer is today.
Yes, so I co-write most of the Big Finish I do. I co-write with my wife, Lauren Mooney, who today is in rehearsals for a show that she's making. She's a theatre producer and dramaturg, and is deep in the weeds with a new show that her company Kandinsky are making. So she sends her apologies for not being in this chat today. I mean, the show they're making at the moment is a sort of school show for young audiences, but they make device theatre, documentary device theatre kind of work on the regs. And that's what she's going to be doing really for the next few months. So it's just me on this chat.
That's all right. So I'll ask you first, what's your memories of the first time you saw the Doctor Who TV movie starring Paul McGann?
Yeah, so the TV movie was such a big thing in my life anyway, in my house. You know, I was 4 years old when the show went off the air, but I'd watched Sylvester McCoy. From my first memories were watching kind of, I think, season 25, so watching Remembrance of the Daleks is kind of the first time I really remember, and the Happiness Patrol, I remember watching those really distinctly. So when it went off the air, it was kind of a great tragedy as far as I was concerned, and I've been very excited by the repeats and the early VHS releases. I got the Spearhead from Space VHS, and that was all, you know, that was a really big thing in my house. And when the Children in Need special came on, that was huge. And, you know, all of that, I was hungry for any and all Doctor Who content. So the TV movie was a big thing. I remember buying the Radio Times and all of that. And we were on holiday. I think I was on holiday with my parents. I'd be 11 years old, and I'd be on holiday with my parents in St. Andrews, where we went every summer for our holiday. And I remember sort of, yeah, settling down to watch it after dinner and just being so absolutely over the moon that Doctor Who was back, and fully anticipating that it was going to lead on to a series of adventures that would run for years and years and years, and being really gutted when that didn't take place.
I feel your pain. Also, talking of St. Andrews, I remember buying VHS of Pyramids of Mars and the John Menzies there.
Oh my God, that John Menzies, yes. Mm. I'm almost certain I will have bought a Doctor Who VHS from that John Menzies as well. I can picture it very clearly. And there was basically St. Andrews, beautiful town we went every year. Only really had two shops of real interest to me, which were Woolworths and John Menzies. And I used to kind of eke them out through the week. So on the first day, I wouldn't go to either. We might stop at the Argos in Kirkcaldy on the way up. And then on the first day, we'd maybe go to just John Menzies or Woolworths. And then the next day, we'd go to Woolworths. And I'd slowly plan what I was going to buy with my holiday money over the week. And it will at least once have been a Doctor Who VHS, almost certainly from that John Menzies.
But that's also bonus points for correctly pronouncing Kirkcaldy. So not a lot
well,
of people
my family's would... from my family's from Fife, so I spent a lot of my childhood up and down from Northumberland, where my parents lived, to Fife, where my grandparents lived. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of happy memories.
We always like having part Scottish people on this podcast. Well, I do. I'm not so sure about Becca, but it becomes a Scottish mafia. So welcome to the gang.
Thank you.
So I suppose when the commission came through to write the Dalby Spook, that must have been a real joy for you, given that it's this particular Doctor, given the importance that he had for you in your childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, both for the importance of that TV movie, but also Paul McGann's been, you know, he's one of my favourite actors in the world. He's one of Lauren's favourite actors. We're both obviously huge fans of Withnell and I, and huge fans of, you know, Alien 3 and various different things. He's kind of been one of those dream actors and for both of us. And I, you know, I'd certainly read a lot of the novels which came and kind of continues at adventures, and listened to some of the Big Finish as well around the Eighth Doctor. So yeah, he was a kind of dream Doctor to write for, and for this to be the first one we got to do was amazing. And you know, also huge fans of Nicola Walker and Hattie Morahan as well. You know, me and Lauren both work in theatre. I work at the National Theatre in London, and so these are all actors who, you know, are real names to conjure with in the theatre world. And you know, and Paul McGann is just one of the kind of, I think, preeminent actors of his generation for both of us. So great to get to write for this trio is just a dream come true.
Yeah, because I remember the first time we spoke last year when we were talking about your River Song story, and I discovered your love of shopping centres, and which is not a bad thing. I'm the same, don't worry. And you mentioned that you may have something that would be of interest to the podcast, and I was like, aha. So yes, it's rather cool that we've got there. So what was in your brief? Was it fairly open, or did you pitch the idea of doing the spook?
Yeah, so the brief was pretty open from Matt Fitton. We were really thrilled that the brief was that they wanted them to be kind of standalone adventures, I think, just because, you know, I think we've both listened to lots of Stranded and everything like that. But the idea of getting to do for a first story, it felt really lovely to be able to just plunge into a totally self-contained world. So the brief was just that it was the Eighth Doctor, Liv and Helen, really, and a one-part story. And what ideas did we have? We went through quite a lot of ideas between the two of us before we landed on this one. But we'd actually wanted to write something about Jeff the Talking Mongoose for quite a long time. We'd sort of encountered him first at a conference called the Haunted Landscape Conference in London. Happens every year. And we'd gone to a lecture about him by Christopher Joseph, who's kind of Jeff's biographer. And we'd sort of decided then that we wanted to do something about Jeff. We'd long discussed what that might be. We wrote a short play about him, which we never sort of staged, but thought there was something in. And it also contemplated whether there was a TV pitch or a film pitch or even a children's novel pitch in it somewhere. And we've always sort of thought, one day we'll do something with Jeff. And then as the first set, I think, of three pitches that we sent Matt, we thought, well, we'll put Jeff in and see what comes out. We'll put the story of the Dolby Spook in. I think we felt like it had a real hook in Jeff the Talking Mongoose, but also we were thrilled that there hadn't really been a Harry Price story in the Doctor Who universe yet. And Harry Price, the paranormal investigator, is someone who we were both really interested in too. And since Harry Price had an encounter with the Dolby Spook, or a kind of encounter with the Dolby Spook, we thought maybe that could all add up to a kind of spooky standalone adventure.
It definitely works. I mean, it must involve quite a lot of research just to find out, you know, get the setting, get the feel of it all, and just find out, you know, get a rough idea as to what was really going on, because it's something that you think, why is this not more commonly known? This is an incredible story.
I know, it's so good. I mean, when we neither of us had really heard, I think I'd seen that there was an Usborne book which had a picture of him in that I remembered from being a kid, of Jeff the Talking Mongoose. But we hadn't really thought about him until we went to this lecture, I'd say, by Chris Joseph at Conway Hall in London. And we were so into it that we then contacted him. He'd said during the lecture that he was about to publish a book via Strange Attractor Press, which is a kind of paranormal press that I'm really into. We buy a lot of books. Both Lauren and I buy a lot of books from them. He was about to publish a book from them, a biography of Jeff, as he said. And so we got in contact with him and said, can we buy you a pint if you tell us some more about the mongoose? And so we ended up taking him for a pint and having kind of a long chat about all things Jeff, and went along to the book launch when the book eventually came out, and found it to be just a really, that's the great thing about it. You say we had to do a lot of research. We kind of, Chris had done all of the research really that you could ever want on Jeff the Talking Mongoose. So we read that book, and then also after that read Harry Price's own book, The Haunting of Cashin's Gap, which is kind of his debunking of the sort of Jeff story, and read a few other sources around and about. But really, I guess I didn't get a chance to. We originally, in the verse version of the script, had a line about Joseph's hot pies as being sold on Douglas as a reference to Chris Joseph. But unfortunately, that got cut for timing purposes. But I really do recommend his book. If you have any interest in Jeff, it's a really comprehensive, almost academic study of the story of what happened there. So that was a huge help. But obviously, in turning that into drama, we've had to take a lot of liberties with what really happened, compress time, compress incident. So I'd say the detail and the world building are all true to life, and also true to Chris Joseph's brilliant account of them. The story itself is not least the fact that the Doctor turns up, but the story of the family and everything is very much a kind of a fantasy around the real events.
I'm curious to know, what is your belief? I mean, what do you think about Jeff? What do you think, he was real?
I don't know. The great thing about Jeff is the thing that's really exciting. I mean, I have a very kind of, I'm kind of supernatural agnostic, I suppose, in that I want to believe kind of Mulder, Fox Mulder kind of way, but haven't ever really had any concrete experiences myself. And Lauren, I think, is more on the skeptic side, but you know, there's still a real interest there. But Jeff's story is so compelling, partly because to the end of her life, Vori Irving, the girl who befriended Jeff, insisted that Jeff was real. The girls who, you know, who had the Cottingley fairies and the guy who produced the great Loch Ness photo, they all in later life admitted that it was a fraud, that it was a kind of concoction. Vori Irving had no reason whatsoever to maintain the story of Jeff. She never made a penny out of it. It was not a source of any income. She wasn't on chat shows. She didn't. It was irrelevant to her life. She died in the 90s, and she insisted that Jeff was real. And when we spoke to Chris Joseph and said, "Well, we might do a play about Jeff or something," he said, "Just make sure that you don't make it look like a fraud, like an obvious fraud, because the great thing about it is the fraud has never been uncovered, if it indeed was a fraud. The story is still open, and the possibility that Jeff was real still exists. And I think, you know, there's precious little in the world that feels truly magical, and this, you know, strange event is one of those things that is allowed to exist in that space between belief and unbelief, I suppose.
Yeah, love it. I'm going to have to go and get this book because I'm fascinated by it, just to get some more facts and find out ultimately what happened to Jeff in the end. So
yeah, I mean, there's all sorts in the book, but there's some great stories. Like, there was an American who believed about 10 years after this all took place that he had caught Jeff. He had a trap. He laid a trap for Jeff, and he caught this mongoose, as he said, on the Isle of Man, and said it was Jeff. But Vori Irving came out of kind of obscurity, semi-obscurity, to say that she'd seen the pictures, she'd read the account, and it wasn't Jeff. It was some other mongoose this American had caught. So he's still on the loose, as far as we know.
Who'd have thought there'd be so many mongoose on Isle of Man? But there we go. The only thing I've ever seen in Isle of Man was Elizabeth Sladen and her family. So I went there in 1994
to
a convention, which was great fun. And there was a great big windmill as well, as I recall. So,
how wonderful. I've never met her. I wish I had.
Wonderful lady. Wonderful. And her daughter Sadie's just as lovely. So yeah. So let's have a wee chat about the scripting process. How did that work? Was it a case of, once you've got your plot, do the scene breakdown and then start developing those scenes? So how did the writing process work? Did you divide them up or did you do them between you?
Yeah, so we've kind of established a bit of a working method. We've obviously had sort of like four big finishes have come out, and we've also got a bunch of others which will be coming out in the next few years in a variety of ranges. But we've kind of perfected, or come close to perfected, a bit of a grand word, but we found a method that works for us anyway, in which we do a treatment together. We kind of plan it out more or less beat by beat, but not scene by scene, together in a conversation. And then we do about 10,000. Well, obviously we have to then send that in for approvals, and that goes in for approvals both from the script editor, the producer of the range, the BBC. There's a, you know, quite a long process, and it's more involved with the Doctor Who main ranges, I think, than maybe some of the other ranges, or it takes a little longer. And then we kind of go at it, and for the first draft we tend to write about 10,000 words each and then hand it back over. Whoever feels kind of most strongly that they know how to set the scene will take the first swing at it and write the first 10,000 words, and then hand it over to the other person, who will then edit the 10,000 words that the first writer has done, and then write their own 10,000 words. And then we kind of go on section by section until we've got a full first draft. And then we usually do a few passes on that each individually and discuss it together until we've got something we're happy to send in. We just do it all on Google Docs. I mean, it's pretty straightforward and primitive, but it's great because you can leave comments for each other, and we get very little time. I mean, because we both work in theatre, it's quite a time intensive job. I mean, a lot of evenings are taken up by it. We don't get a lot of time to sit together and work together on it. So it tends to be we're grabbing hours here and there and doing bits of work on it. We've actually this evening got a kind of treatment chat for a new story that we're doing. And that's going to be us walking around the park near our house for about 45 minutes until we roughly work out what's going to happen. And then from then on, we'll split it up and usually get a draft done in about sort of, about, I don't know, three weeks to a month of going back and forth to get us to a first draft. And then, you know, I think this one had probably three or four drafts went back and forward. The big thing that was tricky with this, first of all, we weren't all that experienced at the range, but also at Big Finish at all when we wrote it. And I think the thing that was a real challenge was balancing the amount of Liv and Helen and the Doctor within the story. And also we had, I'd say, for this range, quite a large number of secondary characters. So we had to establish fairly strong personalities and characters for Voddy, Harry, Price, and Jim Irving, and keeping all of those characters balanced and not ending up shortchanging any of the regulars or the guest parts was quite challenging. So I think they were the biggest hurdles that we had to overcome, particularly balancing out the kind of Liv Helen story with the Doctor story. An hour sounds like a really long time until you try and fit a whole Doctor Who story into it. And then suddenly it feels like every page matters and every line counts. But yeah, it was a really good fun write.
Yeah, I thought you absolutely got all the regulars, you know, perfectly summed up, and I mean, particularly with Liv's disdain at other human beings and just being almost an antisocial nature that she has and being so dismissive. And I thought, yeah, that is so Liv Chenka. I suppose that, you know, capturing that sort of world weariness and sardonic kind of humour was good fun to do.
Oh yeah, she's a great character. I mean, it's just a brilliant, they're a brilliant TARDIS team, I think. They have such depths as characters, they come from such different places, and they play such great foils to Paul McGann's Doctor. So I think, you know, we had a lot of fun getting to sort of inhabit those parts for a while.
And when it comes to writing guest characters, do you have any particular sort of, you know, actors or famous people's voices in mind when you're doing them? You know, just to try and have, you know, some sort of tone that you can be consistent with when it's the two of you working on it. You know, for example, you might want to pick somebody almost like a Stephen Fry kind of voice for one character, or, you know, for Jeff, almost getting like a petulant, like a Vicky Pollard or something. Not that I'm saying that Jeff sounds like Vicky Pollard, but for example, just to get, you know, like a character into your heads when you're doing that.
Yeah, we do. We talk a little bit about what kind of actor you'd have for it. I mean, obviously, casting is a bit of both of our day jobs in a way, and so we do tend to have a think about the kind of personality that the character has. But we both kind of grew up on the same actors and the same TV shows and the same films. One of the things that first kind of sort of cemented our relationship, I think, was that we both grew up with League of Gentlemen, you know, Hammer Horror, Doctor Who, you know, Tales of the Unexpected, all of this, the Avengers, the Persuaders, these kind of programs were both what Lauren kind of was immersed in through her dad. And I was also really was with my family's interest in these programs. So we've got quite a good shorthand, I think, in terms of being able to know what kind of character they are. You know, is it a sort of, you know, Van Helsing kind of character for Harry Price, or is it more of a kind of a Sherlock Holmes kind of figure or whatever it was. So, and you know, I'm a huge fan of Poirot, so I was really delighted with the casting in the end for Harry Price. But yeah, I think we've got hopefully quite a good kind of cultural shorthand to puzzle out who those actors might be. Obviously, we don't really get a say in who they are actually eventually cast as. It's one of the exciting bits of the process is when the script editor, director, or producer, whoever gets in touch, tells you who's going to bring these characters to life.
Did you get along to the recording or sit in and listen to them by any chance?
We do if we can. We didn't on this one, unfortunately. We weren't able to get along to it, but we sat in for a couple of others that we've done recently, and either we've listened in a couple of times, and then we've been down to the studio in London to Soundhouse, where some of them are recorded, which is just a total joy. And it's just amazing to get to watch, because they're put together for, you know, what appears to me to be incredibly quickly and efficiently. You know, these such experienced teams working on Big Finish now, and the actors are able to jump into these characters so rapidly. Yeah, it's quite a feat of casting and engineering and production, and just feels like a really well-oiled machine. So it's a treat to watch it all kind of unfold.
You've mentioned as a Poirot fan you were happy with the casting, so what do you think about the whole ensemble? Because I think it's such a great cast, and I think that Harry Myers just absolutely gives Jeff so much character.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Like, this is probably a bit embarrassing to admit, but we have a sort of a cuddly toy of Jeff the Mongoose at home, like a plush toy that we got soon after we decided that we were faintly obsessed with him. And obviously we do his voice all the time whenever we're, you know, discussing something with him. And Harry sounds, I would say, uncannily like the voice that we do at home. So it felt like coming home to Jeff, really, when we heard what he'd done with it. But it was really fantastic. And it was, I think he found that really great combination of cheeky and otherworldly and strange. And then the great thing about, you know, almost every line that Jeff has in this story is either a direct quote from Jeff the Mongoose himself, or maybe not the ones about the Daleks, but everything else is either a direct quote from Jeff himself or something which is very heavily inspired by the register of Jeff's voice. And it just felt like Harry did such a great job of nailing that. It's this almost kind of like drop dead Fred, imaginary friend, wild, slightly profane register that he speaks in. And Harry sort of such a strange, cheeky voice. And you couldn't really say what he's doing an impression of or where he's got it from. But yeah, we were really delighted by what he came out with.
Yeah. So what were your thoughts when you first got to listen to it? You must have been delighted with it, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, we were so happy. I mean, we were, from the minute the trailer came out, we were over the moon. I think we were on our honeymoon last year when the trailer came out, actually. And the kind of trailer drop is such a huge moment, because if you weren't there for the recording, you don't tend to have any interaction with the story until it comes out or until a trailer comes out. So that moment of first hearing Paul McGann and, you know, and Nicola Walker and all these actors reading the words that you wrote in the story is just amazing. You know, that was really exciting. But I think hearing, we always sort of said that the bit that we were most excited about, but that felt like a real landmark moment in our kind of love for Doctor Who the world, was when we get to write The TARDIS Materializes. It feels like such a huge moment as a writer, and to hear The TARDIS materialize and people to step out of it and say the words you wrote was, you know, it was really huge, really huge. And we were so thrilled with what they did. The sound design is exceptional on it, I think, and the atmospherics are brilliant. I mean, it's a haunted house story, really, at the end of the day, but also one that needs, you know, packed theatres and windswept moorland and, you know, busy beachfronts. And it's such a complex sound designing feat, and lots of things that feel slightly out of the ordinary run of things. And I just thought it was achieved. I think we both thought it was achieved so well.
I suppose that's one of the things when you're writing it, you're able to, with the setting that you've got in Isle of Man in the 30s, you're able to sort of use locations that there'll be a shorthand for us all. We all know what a theatre sounds like. We go, as you say, like the beach, and we can all, you know, get a creaky house, the wind blowing and squeaky floorboards and doors with oil needed in the hinges and things like that.
Yeah, I suppose
having that sort of shorthand, it's, whether it's something like Scooby-Doo or a multi-million pound horror film, there's a shorthand there that helps sell
absolutely
it to us, and being audio is just the perfect medium for it.
Yeah, exactly. And we love a ghost story. I mean, I think like at least half of the stuff we've written for Big Finish has been a ghost story in one sense or another. It's such a malleable genre, I think. And, you know, our favourite episodes of Doctor Who, both of us, I think, growing up were the kind of Hinchcliffe Holmes kind of gothic era. And that's all about, you know, the atmospherics really feel really key to that. It's great to get to play around with that sort of thing.
Yeah. And how did you find rationalising Jeff's existence?
I think we knew from the start that we didn't want to explain exactly what he was, because it felt reductive, I think, to the story, and also would be just a little bit disappointing, I think, if you went, oh, he's just, don't worry, he's just a hologram of an alien civilization had left or something like that, felt wrong. So we were like, well, we want him probably to have some kind of psychic powers, because he's got this link with Volley, and he was sort of telepathy and telekinesis were things which he was rumored to have some kind of control over in the story itself, as originally told. So something kind of psionic, we thought. And then it was actually, I think, when we were trying to work out who the baddie was, that we kind of really kind of got onto it, and we were like, well, what do monkeys fight? They fight snakes. So we're like, oh, well, we'll use the Mara. Like the Mara, what if it's Jeff versus the Mara? That just seems very funny. And the idea of our mongoose story being a sort of like a shadow sequel to Kinder and Snake Dance just seemed really, really silly and fun. but we weren't actually allowed to say it was the Mara because of the various rights things. The Mara at the moment doesn't seem to be available, but we could hint very strongly that it was the Mara. And so I suppose once we knew that it was that kind of creature, something that possesses the mind, it felt natural that Jeff would be a kind of ancient enemy of the Mara, you know, in the way that the Mara is some kind of dark spirit that came out of the dark times or whatever it is of the universe. We figured in the way that a lot of stuff, I think, a lot of the kind of access to that sort of metaphysical weirdness, I tend to reference Stephen King's It a lot, which is like my favorite horror book. And there's this idea, that idea of there being kind of old gods. It's kind of Lovecraftian idea, but the idea that even the darkest forces will have a natural light opposition, something that balances them in the far reaches of the universe or whatever, is really attractive. And yeah, it's just very funny. The Maras is this really annoying talking mongoose, or a Mara, some kind of spirit like that, has to fight an eternal chirpy mongoose. That's just extremely funny to us, I think.
Fantastic. Well, when I go home tonight, I will just make sure I listen very carefully if there's a scuttling behind the skirting box.
Exactly.
Stuart, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for the revelation that it might be the matter, but it really isn't, of course, Christopher Bailey's lawyers.
No, exactly. It's another Mara. It's a friend of the Maras, or a distant cousin.
It's the Cato Mara.
Exactly.
Without being the Rani, Pip and Jane Baker's lawyers. Fantastic. Thanks, and hopefully we'll get to speak again if you get another Eighth Doctor commission.
Oh, I very much hope so, Kenny. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Stuart for taking the time to chat, but wouldn't it be nice if we could hear from the man behind the mongoose? And I don't mean the original one. We're going to chat with the actor who played him. It's Harry Myers.
Hello there, I'm Harry Myers.
What was it like to play Jeff, the mongoose?
Oh, that was one of my favourite roles to date, in anything, not just in it's definitely one of my favourite roles of Big Finish. Jeff the Mocking Tongoose, the Talking Mongoose. Thanks to Kevin Bentley for that. That was just great fun. He just said, off you go and have fun with that. So I just scampered around and chittered in my mind in the studio. And great fun. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Also played Mr. Timms in that episode as well, his kind of failing psychic at the beginning, which was also a nice. I think for some reason, as I said, all the roles I've ever had with Big Finish have been fun in some way. But for some reason, Ken gives me the most fun ones. Ken Bentley and me, he always gives me like, these silly fun roles. So yeah, Jeff was up there, I think, with my favourites.
It's a bizarre one because I had no idea that it was based on real events until I read up all about it. Amazing.
Sure, yeah. I had a good look through all of the stories and the different things people have made. Yeah, there's all sorts of articles and a couple of little bits of films about the whole thing. And it's a fascinating story, you know. You'd think it's one of those things that, if you wrote it, you wouldn't believe it, which is, you know, obviously that's the result we've got. We've got Mr. Timms, Jeff the Talking Mongoose, and but obviously if you take out, obviously there's the Doctor Who end of it, which is not real, but if you take that out, still the story's bonkers and it's real. And that was fascinating. Really, really enjoyed that one.
Love it. That's amazing. Harry, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Great talking to you.
Thank you, Harry, for giving us your time there. Now, if I know you, Kenny, you're planning weeks, if not months, if not years ahead for your podcasts. So you'll have doubled up on interviews, won't you? I know that you did the story Albie's Angels from these box sets early in the year, and I know that the Dalby Spook had the same sound designer and musician.
You're absolutely correct. You do know me far too well. When you've seen my list of podcasts that I've got planned, in fact, I'm holding up now. That's ones that probably keep us going into 2027. But
Kenny holding that list up there, that piece of paper, holding that up there for the benefit of our YouTube viewers.
Absolutely, all of you. So that's an exclusive for you there. But I had a chat with the sound designer Benji Clifford, and you're a big fan of his, aren't you?
Oh, I love Benji Clifford. God bless him. No one makes me laugh like Benji Clifford. Like, the number of times I've had to DM him and tell him that I've been in the middle of Asda listening to something that him and Mr. Briggs have said on the Big Finish podcast that has just stopped me in my tracks and had me laughing and got me funny looks. It's unbelievable. It doesn't happen every week, but it does happen most weeks, yes. No one makes me laugh like Benji Clifford. Listeners, if you don't listen to the Big Finish podcast, you really should. There's a lot of good chat on it as well as all the advertising bump.
Absolutely. So let's hear from Mr. Clifford.
Hello, my name is Benji Clifford, and I'm the sound designer for the Dolby Spook.
This must have been one that made you smile when you got through the script to think, okay, talking mongoose, here we go.
It's classic Big Finish territory, isn't it? It's, you know, I always, when I receive the scripts, look it over and see what I'm in for, as it were, what I've got to do. And, of course, yeah, when you see something like this, you think, right, okay. But as I was reading it, I really enjoyed just how absolutely bonkers it was, and just the idea of actually having to do something with it. But yeah, it's a really bizarre story, but a really fun one.
Did you do any reading up on it? Because ever since I heard this, I've gone and heard, I must have listened to about half a dozen podcasts and read so much online, because I'd never heard of them before. Had you?
Well, that's it. It's the type of thing I didn't, you know, you just sort of read it and you think, wow, you know, somebody's clearly had a crazy idea. And then I can't remember what led me to actually looking it up and finding it was a thing. And then my mind was just blown. I mean, I can't remember the full details, but it was just, I remember reading it thinking, this is just crazy. It's actually, well, I don't know if, did it actually happen? Depends how much of a skeptic you are. But it's bizarre to think. It's bizarre to think anything like that could possibly occur.
That's what I thought, but it made the news back in the day, so maybe it was a slow news day, who knows. So this, I suppose with this one, initial thoughts you'd have would be, okay, you've got to get the sounds for a scampering mongoose scurrying behind walls and getting his little pitter-patter of feet, and then working out a voice treatment as well.
Well, it's the type of script that really demanded... It's quite complex sound design work, in the sense that it's because you know you're dealing with something. You've got to make something out of nothing, as it were. And I know that's the case with all actors and, you know, all voice actors and characters within the story. But this is very much a case of you have to really make something, and it moves around the stereo field a lot. You know, part of it is it's crawling through the housing of the house. You know, the house, it's going up through the roof behind the walls. So you've really got to move this thing around within the stereo field. And yeah, a lot of it was, you know, I've got a great little thing. It's called a cajon, which is, if you're ever out busking, is a box that people sit on and they use it to drum, and it's probably the most expensive wooden box I've ever bought. It's a fantastic tool for sound design for things like wood and stuff, because it's inside it. It's actually got, it uses these sort of chain wires to sound like a snare drum. So I taped those down to stop them rattling, and then I've just got a nice hollow wooden box. So I recorded myself, you know, scratching it and hitting it and really, you know, manipulating it as much as I could. And then I had loads to play with. And then, of course, it's how far do you go with the voice? So with Harry Myers doing the voice, he gave such a fantastic performance. In terms of, you know, really, because it's quite an ask, isn't it? You know, oh yeah, you just got to be a talking mongoose. Oh yeah, yes, I've done that many times. You know, it's bonkers, but I think bonkers actually is the perfect word for it, because it was just bonkers. So I think we opted in the original cut. I left it completely blank and just thought, well, you know, it's some crazy sort of magic going on here, isn't there? So, but actually, I think in the end we sort of just pitched it up a little bit. We didn't go too crazy, because I think if you go too mad with it, you'll lose a bit of that sort of the fun energy of it all.
Absolutely. I think it's one of those ones, when having listened back to it over the past week, it's just been fantastic just to think there's so much love and attention to detail in there. It's everything there. It's in the script, it's in the performances, it's in your work, it's in Jamie's work, and it's just the passion that goes into these projects, and it's just lovely the way it comes across.
And you get a lovely, you know, a lovely bit of work from Hattie Morahan there with Helen, who really gets to kind of come out of her shell and be a little bit defensive, as it were, and kind of, and I really like that in the story. You know, I care so deeply for the characters. They're sort of like friends, because I work with them an awful lot, You know, it's my main, I guess my main contribution to Doctor Who is doing the Eighth Doctor stuff. So, you know, it's nice to see where the adventure takes these characters and where they go, you know, where they go. And so it's lovely when they do get a chance to really shine.
And do you ever get the chance to, you know, to listen to back to the stories you've worked on? You know, we're talking like months, if not years down the line, just for a, oh, I think I'll put something on, I'll pop on whatever it may be, something such as Stranded or Doom Coalition, something like that.
I've had a few sort of flirts with the past. I try again, it's down to, you know, time. I think part of it is I always want to improve my technical abilities and skills, and so part of it, listening back can sometimes be a bit of a weird thing because you listen back and think, oh, why did I make that decision or why did I do that? But of course you forget the context of why you do things in the past. But I occasionally listen back. I'd actually argue I listen back more to the Survivors stuff than I do the Doctor Who stuff. Why that is, I don't know. Maybe I just like the apocalypse. Maybe, I don't know. But it's nice sometimes to go back and listen to them. But again, we have such a huge volume of Big Finish stuff that it's actually, why do I need to listen to old stuff when there's so many things coming out all the time?
Yes, I know that one well, as we go forward with the 7-8 releases a month, but long may it continue. Keeps us out of mischief. Benji, thanks again.
You're very welcome, Kenny.
I actually caught up with Benji in April when I was down at the recording of a McGann story, and he was a sound engineer in charge of the recording and was fantastic. So we've heard from Benji, let's hear from the other person who helped bring the story to life, Jamie Robertson, who was doing the fantastic score.
Hello everyone, I'm Jamie Robertson and I was the music composer for Dolby Spook.
Welcome back, Jamie, always good to see you. And especially when you're busy on top secret work at the moment, so we'll not go into that, we'll move on swiftly. Let's turn the clock back to last year and the Dolby Spook comes through. A talking mongoose. Had you ever heard of this story whatsoever? Because I hadn't, and it's amazing.
No, I'll be honest, we do a lot of these stories that are based on like myths and creatures, don't we? And I've never really... I don't know. No, that doesn't always click at first. What the guys are doing, the writers are doing, where they're connecting them up to legends and stuff like that. But yeah, no, it was very interesting and mystical sort of show. And obviously with our usual bunch of Liv, Helen, and the Doc running around trying to save the day. And it's quite. Do you know what every I don't know if I've said this before, but every Eighth Doctor I've worked on is always refreshing. It's always different. You know, you go in one way and then suddenly the story goes another way. So for every next story that I work on, so yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I'd imagine though, by the fact that you've got a character like a mongoose in the story, that sort of like the way they move and things like that, does that sort of influence you when you're doing the score at all? Where you're just thinking like the way that an animal would move and scurrying about with that energy and then stopping and going again?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it was a visual production, yeah, but when it's audio drama, I'm just more focused on the dialogue, what's going on, unless there's specific areas that I need to like sting or stab with the sound design. But obviously, Benji always never lets you down with his sound design. And so I don't envy him what he had to work on.
He's saying that he's got one of those wooden boxes that you see that people playing, you know, using it like a drum, and that's where he managed to get all the scratching sounds for Jeff.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I remember once when I was working on something, and it was the one with the Eighth Doc where it was the wind up clock.
Doom Coalition.
Oh, thinking back to the Eighth Doctor's Adventures now, when we was doing the monthly series, and I had to use a load of...
Oh, yes, The Tick and the Talk.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I can't remember
Steve Lyons, Time Works.
Yeah, I had to use a load of drumsticks to do the walking.
Wow.
And I've got them here, actually, yeah. So and I was outside walking along. People think, what's he doing with drumsticks on the floor, you know? If you lost your drum kit, mate, you know.
Or you're the world's worst drummer and can't actually find the drums.
That's it, yeah, yeah. But I've done some weird stuff over the time for sound design. I'll tell you, dragged a computer computer case, the old down the street for a Dalek being dragged and all sorts. Oh. So I'm sure I mean, now I think people like Benji have done a lot more sound design than me on these big finishes, and they've probably got more stories to tell, but yeah, that's where the horror stories lie.
I suppose that's the great thing, is that, as I know that you often do quite a lot of your music and sound design yourself, but I suppose this way you sort of, it does, it becomes more collaborative. That must make it slightly more enjoyable in a way, so that you know that it's not all on you, and it does give you that sort of team feeling. You can, you know, you can chat to Benji about saying, oh, he's got this, he can flag things up to you, and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's now worked out how I work. I mean, Nick always, when some directors that we'll get, especially newer directors, they'll think, oh, you've left a gap in the sound design or something, but Nick knows when I'm going to put something like building up on a sting or something in, when there's a sound design job going, and I think Benji's actually started to do the same thing, where he's worked out, I bet Jamie's going to put something climatic there at the scene, and he'll leave the space, you know. And sometimes on the end of the, well, a lot of times on the end of the scenes as well, he'll leave it so there's a roll off of the background sound, and then I can shift the scenes a little bit to how I need it to put the amount of transition music in. And but yeah, I think it's just a case of working together for so long. It just works. Hopefully it works.
It does. Believe me, it does. Do you believe anything about the Dolby Spook? Do you think there may have been something in it? Some people say it might have been a poltergeist type haunting of an animal.
Really? Well, you know me, I'm into the paranormal. Do all my ghost hunts with my paranormal talk shoes and that. Yep. And I've not really looked into it too much. Maybe I might go and have to. You've jogged my memory, because this was a while ago now we worked on this, so I might have to go and have a look again, actually, into the whole thing and see. Just Isle of Man, wasn't it?
It was indeed. See, I remember your paranormal stuff, because I remember we talked about it between ourselves previously, but there's about 30 plus podcasts all about Jeff. And they're really, really interesting.
So you've sounds like you've been into it, yeah.
I've really like got into it. I've been sort of doing a lot of online reading, and yeah, I've been quite obsessed with this little guy. So yeah, I would hugely highly recommend. There's tons of podcasts. I think it's the British Folklore one was very, very good. So about a guy who'd written a book about the whole thing. So
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, I'm gonna have to go and look now.
Brilliant. Right, I won't hold you back. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. Bye, bye then.
So our thanks to Stuart, Harry, Benji and Jamie for taking the time to join us to chat about the Dolby Spook. Remember, if you've enjoyed today's Pieces of Eighth, or indeed liked any episode that we've done, especially the ones that I've been on, please do leave a review for us on iTunes or your podcast provider, as it means more people can find our episodes, and it's always appreciated. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Pieces of Eighth.
And we have our Facebook group too, so feel free to join us on there, as we quite often plug episodes and reveal what they are when they're ready to go. We'll be back next week with a journey to look at the making of a recent Big Finish short trip, as we feature Death Will Not Part Us. It's one you really need to concentrate on, as it's very timey-wimey. So talking of all things timey-wimey, why don't you pop off, listen to it, and join us again on Pieces of Eighth in 7 days' time. So until then, I've been Kenny Smith.
And I was David Steele. And I'm still not the former leader of the Liberal Party.
Bye-bye, everyone.